If every guy in America woke up on his 50th birthday and he was suddenly having all day, all night hot flashes, brain fog that made him incapable of functioning at work, and a penis that was now the size of a breakfast sausage so that he could never have sex again, but he had to pee roughly every 20 minutes, no doubt there would be the declaration of a national health emergency with daily updates on CNN and every pharmaceutical company scrambling to be the first to come up with a magic pill to help the poor guys. And they would definitely not be told by their doctors to suck it up. This is just a normal part of aging. But that was exactly the suggestion of a major medical journal who recently published a series of articles saying that menopause had been over-medicalized. Many symptoms were all in her head. And that overall, women should navigate menopause without the need for medical treatments. The response on the part of a group of furious menopause experts? Strap in. I'm here with Dr. Mary Claire Haver to tell you what happened next. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Dr. Mary Claire Haver needs no introduction. But for the two people in America who do not know who she is, Dr. Haver is a board-certified gynecologist, a certified menopause practitioner of the Menopause Society, and the developer of the Galveston Diet, a groundbreaking approach to how women eat that has helped so many peri- and postmenopause women lose weight, get in shape, in addition to how to best navigate the hormonal changes that will ultimately occur in 100% of women. Welcome, Dr. Haver. This is early in the morning for both of us, right?
It's worth it, though.
I was going to say some things are worth getting up early because, quite frankly, I think this whole thing has been keeping us up nights anyway. You know, we're going to get to the specifics of the article in a minute, but I know what my reaction was when I got it. You know, one of our colleagues, Dr. Corinne Menn, sent it to me. And honestly, I thought it was a spoof. I thought it was a joke. I couldn't believe that this was in an actual medical article. So what was your initial reaction when you started to read it?
So I had done a podcast, I think on Thursday, with a doctor in the UK. And offline, she and I were just chatting and she said, "Do you know what's coming?" And I was like, "No." And she said, "The Lancet is going to publish this whole series on menopause." I was like, "Oh my God, that's amazing." She said, "No, wait till you read it." And she initially sent me the press release and I was stopped in my tracks. It was one of the most emotional reactions I have ever had to reading something. And I could not believe, I mean, this is The Lancet.
Let me just back up a little bit because everyone might not be familiar with The Lancet. So The Lancet is one of the oldest, most respected medical journals. It's international. It has been around for like 100 years. And The Lancet is the go-to for physicians, not just in the US, but truly all over the world.
I mean, think New England Journal, but bigger, more countries, you know?
Right. I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, this is what people read all over the world. And I looked up to see what the impact is. And they have roughly 100 million downloads annually. So, I mean, we're talking crazy. This is not just a US thing. And this particular article was written by an Australian gynecologist who I'd never heard of, Dr. Martha Hickey, and there are a bunch of other authors too. But that's so The Lancet, that's what came out. And I also got the press release, the embargoed. So I knew about it when it was coming. So keep going. Then what happened?
So I read the press release and I'm astounded, but it's a press release and it's meant to inflame people or, you know, but the wording of, you know, the headline was, "We're over-medicalizing menopause." And I just thought, what? I knew this was going to be bad. Then we got over the weekend, we were able to see the actual article, which was under embargo. So we couldn't share it publicly, but, you know, amongst our group of like-minded menopause, actual people who take care of menopausal patients, we sent it out amongst our group and we all immediately had the same reaction. And so, I mean, I just wrote a book about menopause. I've read over 2,000 articles in the last year and I went through it line by line. I made a spreadsheet, which we sent to our menopausy, and I looked at all the points they were trying to make And I realized very quickly, this was cherry-picked data. They went after this with a bias. This was not balanced at all. Usually, like in the Menopause Society, you know, or in any respected journal, when you have information like a review put in front of you, which is basically, this was an opinion piece or review, or you see the good, the bad, the ugly, you know, they show both sides of the story.
Right.
Research that supports a thought, research that would maybe negate a thought, and they kind of what they think. There was so much overemphasis on certain things, underemphasis on others, with a really direct narrative of.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, because I'm on the editorial board of Menopause, the journal. Right. So I know what happens. And quite frankly, if this article had come across my desk, I would have said, are you kidding? We're not going to publish this. This is ridiculous. So, I mean, I, of course, had the same reaction you did and every other academic menopause expert who's out there taking care of patients. I mean, when the text started flying and I thought, if steam could be coming out of my phone, I thought my phone was going to, you know, truly just explode, because all of us were like having chest pain. I mean, we just couldn't believe that this was actually out there. Like you said, cherry-picked, biased, and like, who are these people?
Anti-woman, you know, anti-woman. And I thought, okay. You know, first I was very upset. Like, this is going to set women back so far. Like, all the work that we've done, how far we've come bringing menopause to the mainstream, discussing it. And, you know, they even went after that, that basically we should not be talking about menopause on social media because we're upsetting people. And, you know, but then I thought, okay, who are these people? So I dug into the authors, like you said, Martha Hickey from Australia, one of the chief investigators of the Women's Health Initiative. That woman had a pound of flesh, you know?
Yeah.
In her press release, she was very specific to use the words, women have been misled, which was the title of the New York Times article.
Of course.
Data,
right.
How it was presented. So, and, you know, I pulled the Oscar Wilde quote this morning in preparation for this, because I've heard this before. It's really difficult to take a person and change their mind about something if their job depends on it. And I thought, these people, this is their job. They're entrenched in this bias. They're entrenched in this narrative. This is what they've made their reputations, their jobs on. And this is their chance to lay down the world as they see it. And we just disagree.
Except, I mean, come on. I mean, it's one thing if this was, if this was an opinion piece in some newspaper, okay. But this is supposed to be a medical journal. You know, yesterday I was doing a webinar to, you know, women, not to a medical crowd. And there were like, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of people on the webinar. And during the Q&A, the very first question that came in was, don't you think you're over-medicalizing menopause? Because, of course, I've been talking about all of the things that we do, hormonal, non-hormonal options to mitigate the hot flashes and the insomnia, blah, blah, blah. And I was just, I probably overreacted, and I'm thinking, okay, calm down. You know, this is Zoom. These people don't know what's been going on. And I just gave our standard response of, you know, I don't know what you mean by that. You know, are we over-medicalizing erectile dysfunction because we're giving guys Viagra? And are we over-medicalizing hearing loss and losing our sight because we wear glasses and hearing aids? And no, this is about, you know, our length of life, not just quality of life. But that point is that was from someone who, okay, didn't necessarily know better. Right. This article was from supposed, who are from experts.
I mean, experts. Yeah.
Is okay. Before we get to the specifics. So we gather together this group, your menopause posse, and these menopause posse, and we're not just OBGYNs. I mean, we had family medicine doctors, cardiologists, internists, urologists, medical oncologists, psychiatrists, an orthopedic surgeon, nurse practitioners, therapists. You know, we're talking about people that take care of menopause women every day in the real world. So you get this group of people together and say, we have to respond. What happened next?
You know, we all felt the same way. And, you know, after we got our fury out of the text, like back and forth in the smoke, it's okay. We have more power than we think. This had a very similar playbook to the Women's Health Initiative and how they released that data. And we were not willing to let that happen again, because you, me, all of us have patients, followers. You know, we've built a community around menopause care, and we can reach a lot of people really quickly, which was not available in 2002 when this happened the first time. And so we kind of waited for the other medical societies to respond, and the Australian Society came in really quickly, and I think the Canadian. Menopause Society came in quickly, you know, basically saying a couple of good points, but, you know, we don't agree. And we're like,
the data is problematic. Yeah.
This is very problematic on multiple levels. So we're like, we don't want this to get hold in the US. So when the press release came out, it was huge in the UK, huge in Ireland. You know, I was getting, you know, my followers are all over the world. I was getting multiple, very Australia. It was humongous. It was a little bit of a sleeper in the US.
Yeah.
Little articles here and there, but nothing like CNN putting it on the front page.
No.
And I think because they knew what the backlash would be, because women are not going to stand for it. And
or they just didn't care. You know, there's that too. I'm just throwing that out there.
So we were like, in case our patients see this, in case the women who are actually out there suffering see this and now don't feel worse, especially the mental health article, I was trying to calculate how many suicides would happen based on this article alone.
And let's say if you're having a hard time, it's your fault mentality. I mean, that was the part that, well, we're going to go through some of the specifics of it, but that was the part that I think all of us just like practically started shaking, you know?
And in an effort, not for us, it's for our patients, for these women out there. I was like, get behind me, girls. I got you. You know, like I know the data, you know, and I know this was cherry picked and I'm not going to let this get propagated through, you know, providers' offices on the front line who are now like, am I over-medicalizing menopause?
Yeah, maybe I don't need to learn about hormone therapy. Maybe they should just get a fan and dress in layers. Like, about a return to the 1800s.
Exactly. So, you know, their solutions were, you know, how do we deal with menopause was basically suck it up and get a fan. This will end eventually, you know, point by point.
Let's go through some of those points because what we did is we put together a response and we weren't quite sure what we were going to do with the response. And we'll talk about that, but we wanted a written response. And one of the things is like, I think any one of us could have easily written 20 pages in response, but we really had to, if you will, cherry pick which of the points were the most egregious that made us the craziest that we really felt like we needed to respond to. So I'm going to bring up four of the specific points that we responded to that we just thought, okay, we have to be on top of this. So point one, they stated, quote, most women navigate menopause without the need for medical treatments. The response.
So our response was, according to the data, most women navigate the menopause without the option for treatment. So if you look at the actual data, if you look at in 2020, I believe they surveyed internal medicine, family medicine, and OB-GYN residents coming out, kind of the who were supposed to be the front line of women's healthcare, right? The primary care doctors. 7% felt competent in treating menopause.
And that's that they felt competent. It doesn't really mean they were competent. I'm just throwing that out there. But we're talking like almost nobody.
They knew that it was important, but they did not feel that they'd received enough training and education to make themselves competent at offering care.
Right. And also that article that just came out showing that only 20% of programs, OBGYN programs, supposedly the experts, actually teach menopause as part of their curriculum. And we say teach, we use that, you know, it's a very low bar. It's like they had one lecture, maybe gave them an article and said, here, read this. So no wonder nobody feels like they know what they're doing. And no wonder most women are not getting treatment. It has nothing to do with they decline it. It's because no one is offering it to them.
And for me, for 15 years, I was a terrible menopause provider.
We didn't know.
We were doing other stuff.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until my own personal journey and menopause. So I was a residency program director for 10 years. Yeah. I know what the curriculum said. So I'm like, so the first point was just like, it's not that they're doing it without because they don't want it or they're not being offered or it's not even discussed at their visits.
Right. There's a reason why only 7% of women in this country take hormone therapy. It's not because they wouldn't benefit. It's because they're not offered it or they're taken off of it. And we can go on and on about that. Okay. Let's get to the second point, which, you know, as I read through these, no matter how many times I read through them, I still get angry every single time. Okay. During the menopause transition, women should challenge self-critical beliefs, which can make hot flushes worse. I mean, there are Okay, just okay, go.
Oh, this is problematic on multiple levels. The smacks of misogyny, the smacks of the patriarchy. And I hate using those words because I think they're overused. But this is the underbelly of medical history of the world on how women are treated. Taking something biological. We know where the receptors are on the thermoregulatory center in the brain that cause a hot flash. There is a pathophysiologic process that has nothing to do with your psychology of what is happening when estrogen levels drop and what happens to the thermoregulatory center in 85% of women and how that can be so disruptive. And their suggestion that if you just think it away or think positive about your hot flash is somehow going to make it better. Cognitive behavioral therapy has multiple functions in medicine, but to use it as primary therapy for menopausal symptoms is ludicrous. And it's continuing the narrative that is pervasive in the history of medicine that women's biological processes are due to a psychological disorder. Yeah. Well, I will not stand for it.
Well, none of us will stand for it. And the other thing also that just made me absolutely crazy was this idea of, and you know what? It's a hot flash. It's not harmful. It's like, oh my God, do they not know the data that the women that have the worst hot flashes are the ones that are most likely to get severe cardiovascular disease, which is the number one killer of women. And it's like, what are they asleep at the wheel? Are they not reading the data? Are they not aware? So that one, I didn't even know what to do with it. So
it's mind blowing. And
it really is mind blowing. Okay. It gets worse.
Yes.
Okay, let me go on to the next one. I really have a hard time even reading these. Okay, on the basis of scarce data, we found no compelling evidence that risk of anxiety, bipolar disorder, or psychosis is universally elevated over the menopause transition.
So curious use of the word universal. This is very much, they used language, I think, that was deliberately confusing. There's no universal anything in life.
For anybody. Only 70% of guys get erectile dysfunction when they're 70. It's not universal, but it's still bad.
So that's like me saying there's no evidence to support that erectile dysfunction is a universal problem found in men. That is basically what that's saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a plethora of data just published from Australia, 8-fold increase over the menopause transition of depressive disorders. You know, we have data after data after data.
One out of four women in this time of life is taking an antidepressant. I mean, last week's podcast was just about the impact of SSRIs. And my conclusion at the end of it was, I'm not saying that a lot of women don't benefit from SSRIs, but the majority of them that are put on an SSRI during the perimenopause transition would be far better served to be put on appropriate hormone therapy instead of having their sex lives in the toilet and other symptoms as a result of the talk about over-medicalization. You know, that's wrong medicalization. I think that's what they need to be addressing, is the wrong and the under-medicalization. Yeah.
So, yeah, that when you look at, you know, the CDC data in the US of you have a 10% chance of being on an SSRI until you're 40, and then that doubles to 20, and then at 60, it goes up to 25%.
Like, that's right.
There's nothing unique about being a female other than hormone changes that men don't go through nearly as, I mean, you know, you can't even equate the two, andropause and menopause. And just the casual dismissal of all of this data, cherry picking things from 1946 and so that to fit their narrative of, well, mental health really is not affected by menopause.
Yeah. It's right, exactly. Mental health, mood. I also thought it was just kind of an interesting coincidence that this was released at the exact same time as Dr. Lisa Mascani's book, The Menopause Brain, which I know both you and I are very familiar with it and have spoken with her. And basically, she lays out the biology of estrogen receptors in the brain, what happens when we lose our estrogen in terms of dopamine and serotonin, which of course are going to have a huge impact on mood and on mental health. And oh my God. And then to have them come out and say, yeah, it's not real. There's no data. And it's like, I almost wonder, like, was there like, what was their agenda? What was, I mean, what your agenda, what you're saying is that they were just trying to make a name for themselves, that they were trying to come out and say, we have a different approach. But I don't want to like get all conspiracy theory and nefarious and stuff, but it just seems like it was just so off the wall that you have to wonder what else was behind all of this.
So they quoted, I had the data, they quoted 200 or 160 articles in the first, you know, out of the thousands and thousands that are out. There's 94,000 articles written on menopause. They picked 100 and something. And they, 20 or 17%, almost 20% were their own research. So it really, really is heavily biased on what their work has been. And not to say it's terrible work, but the two main authors, one was the lead investigator for the Women's Health Initiative, and the other was Martha Hickey, who is, I mean, I've seen quotes from her. I've like kind of did a deep dive, like, why would this woman do this? This is her stance. This has been her stance forever. Old women are not estrogen-starved younger women. And basically, really negating the health and protective effects of estrogen in our bodies through the lifespan. She just completely dismisses that.
That's really the salient point, is for so long we were focused on short-term symptoms. And now those of us in this world, yes, we continue to be concerned about short-term symptoms and the impact on life and menopause and life and in the workplace and relationship and all of that, and just general quality of life. But for us, we're really focused on the impact on length of life. I mean, I you know, mentioned cardiovascular disease. That, of course, is not the only thing. We're looking at bone health. We're looking at cognitive function. We're looking at bladder health. We're looking at sexual health throughout the lifespan. I mean, we're talking a long-term impact of the fact that we have estrogen receptors literally every single place in our body, you know, aside from our skin and our hair. I mean, it's just everywhere. This, okay, I'm going to get to the last point. Over-medicalization of menopause can lead to disempowerment and over-treatment.
So that's so interesting, because what's happening clinically to females is they go in with their laundry list of symptoms. We have a set of clinicians who has never been trained to connect the dots that all of these things might actually have a common cause, which is estrogen deprivation or sex hormone deprivation. So they go to the cardiologist for their palpitation, the neurologist for their headaches, the, you know, orthopedic surgeon for their frozen shoulder, the, you know, and no one's like, wait, this actually could all be part of her menopause. And let's do a trial of hormone therapy and see what gets better. And then we can send her to the specialist, you know, because women end up on psychiatric meds, on sleep meds, on cholestatins, on all of these different medications, where they probably just could, you know, a lot of them could have just been started on hormone therapy at an appropriate age. And that's all they needed.
Yeah. Well, and we hear this every day. You know, I was talking to a group of women last night. I was giving a talk, and one of the women there was a physician. And she said, I cannot tell you how frustrated I was that when I was perimenopausal and I was flashing and I couldn't sleep, and I went to my OBGYN, who I know and is an otherwise good OBGYN, and was told, well, I can give you an SSRI. And then she said, and then I went to my internist. And then, and she like went through the list and said, all I wanted was for someone to give me some hormone therapy. And every single one of them looked at me horrified and said, oh no. And of course, because she was a physician, because she'd read the literature herself, she kept pursuing it until she actually showed up in my menopause center at Northwestern, where she got appropriate treatment. But that's the point, is that not only are women being given the wrong treatment, but they are being dissuaded from the right treatment. If someone says, no, I think I really would benefit from taking hormone therapy, and they're told, no. So, and then they call it over-medicalization. To your point, yeah, they're over-medicalized with the wrong treatments. Instead of
they're getting polypharmacy when they just needed to get some hormones back and levels back.
And some help with lifestyle changes and all the things that, you know, I mean, it's never in a vacuum. And these people who think that they're just going to take hormones and everything's going to be perfect, of course.
No,
but that's just not the answer. That's one
piece
of it.
That kept you healthy in your 30s and early 40s.
Yeah. Exactly. Which, of course, is what you've spent your life talking about and helping women with. All right. So we write this thing, And we're thinking, and when we say we, so what happened was there was a group of what, how many, 10 in the
10 of us,
who, 10 of us in this original group that was putting this together and rewording it and working it. But then we got it out to our colleagues and said, hey guys, we really want support on this. Would you like to sign this rebuttal? And boy, did we get an amazing response. How many names are we up to now?
251, and they're all over the world. We have all over Europe, the UK, Australia, but the majority are the US, because that's where most.
And these, the people that sign this, I mean, these are the top people. These are, in our world, you know, we have the people who are the ones who are writing the papers, who are running the societies, who are teaching in medical schools, in addition to actually seeing women in menopause clinics and all that. So these are the people who are on the front lines. And I don't think, did we have anyone that said, no, I'm not comfortable signing this, that we approached?
Just barely a couple who wanted to sign, but were worried about the backlash from their institution because they may or may not work with some of the authors.
That's right. Or people who were like high up in a society or something, right, who felt like, well, I have to get the backing of the society, even though I personally want to sign it. Okay, so here we have this kick-ass rebuttal. We have over 200 signatures, and we submitted it to the journal, to Lancet, to the editorial department. I know this will shock everyone. We have not heard back yet. They have not said, oh, thank you. We're going to publish this right away. I don't know about you. I'm kind of expecting not to hear back at all. So then we thought, okay, well, certainly, you know, the New York Times is going to be interested in this, or, you know, the LA Times or CNN, or, you know, I don't know. Where are we now? Who's picking this up?
New York Times was a pass, and they said, we're not going to write an article about an article, right? You know, like, this is a response to another news story, you know, come to us, and it made sense. And so,
except I kind of disagree with that, because it's not a news story. It's a response to a scientific article that was published in an international medical journal. So I understand their response, and you and I both worked with the New York Times a lot, so we kind of get it and get how they do things. But I think this is a little different.
So some of the advice we got from people who've published a lot in these space was like, so we're working with STAT, which is a medical news publication, and they are planning on publishing it. So we're in the middle of that right now. And then basically we can write an editorial similar to the conversation we're having. And I think, you know, really what this represents is kind of old school menopause versus new school menopause. And yeah. People kind of entrenched.
Well, I would take it even a step further. Evidence-based menopause versus non-evidence-based menopause.
Right. And the thing that sets us apart from people who've tried to put a toe in the water in the menopause space before is evidence, yeah. I think. And that all of us are 100% evidence-based, meaning things aren't going to come out of our mouth on social media or whatever. If it's our opinion, we will state so, but we're all having research to back it up. When we wrote the rebuttal, it is linked to several articles proving our points.
Every sentence is linked to a well-regarded journal article, peer-reviewed, meaning that a journal that you can't get published unless you have established that what you're saying is true. And there was a lot of work that went into this document, and we'd like to see it go somewhere, explode someplace, but it sounds like it is on the right path, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. And I also, you know, I mean, it's one thing for all of us to be involved at this. It's, I don't know what kind of backlash, as word gets out about this, there will be in the general population and women who are now mobilized to say, we need to pay attention to menopause. We need to know this. We need to get the help that we need, because I think that this is part of the whole movement. You know, we hear so often menopause is having a moment. I'm older than you. So I have been, you know, this is not a moment for me. I have been screaming and yelling and teaching and talking about this stuff forever. And I don't even know if you know this, but Way back when Oprah did her segment on bioidentical hormones with Suzanne Summers, may she rest in peace, I was the doctor that was on there saying, oh no, oh no. So I've been talking about menopause for a long, long time. So yes, I'm happy that it's having a moment, but the problem with it being trendy now is that we have a lot of people out there who are just more concerned about being trendy than about being factual. And I mean, okay, you and I can both tear our hair out at the TikTok influencers who say, eat more broccoli and this will balance your hormones and you don't need to take hormone therapy. But we can pull our hair out and roll our eyes. But at the end of the day, we say, okay, you know, they're TikTok influencers. This right. is different. This is different. These are real supposed academic experts who are coming out with this nonsense. So it takes it to a whole new level.
What we were worried, you know, is that these frontline providers who have received very little training and education on menopause, who are trying to do their best, will see this Lancet article and be like, yeah, I can't, you know, really this, she just needs to get over it. And
well, right. It'll validate their not knowing what to do. It'll say, see, she doesn't need hormone therapy. She just needs to think positive thoughts.
Right. Wish your way away. You know, turn on your fan, grab some ice water. It's going to be okay.
Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice? All right, let's take a few minutes in the time we have left to calm down, to, you know, just take a breath. And for the like three people out in the world who don't know you and what you do in your work, let's talk about you for a few minutes. So tell me, what do you do out there? Talk about the Galveston diet. Talk about your work.
Sure. My name is Mary Claire Haver, and I am board certified OB-GYN. I'm also certified by the Menopause Society, and I have this really cool other certification from Tulane in culinary medicine. So in about 2015, I started to get really interested in how a menopausal woman could approach nutrition, really because I was struggling with visceral fat gain in my own menopause when I was fairly fit before. I was also grieving my brother's death and, you know, my habits had kind of gotten out of control. And then I, you know, was trying to get healthy again, which in my mind back then meant thin. And I was struggling, really failing at it. And so all the habits that had worked for me before, the little tricks to lose the 10 pounds or whatever, weren't 20 pounds weren't working. So I got really interested in like, what am I doing wrong? What are we doing wrong? Like the only nutrition thing I'd ever done was that Xerox copy of the gestational diabetic diet, you know, that we all had in residency.
Oh my God. Talk about blast from the past
in my life. And so I talked to my chairman at the time when I was still at the academic institution. And I said, hey, I really want to take this course. He said, do it. Absolutely. So, you know, it was online. I had to fly to New Orleans and go to San Antonio for lab. We worked in kitchens with dietitians and it was really cool. So I just learned
so much. Sounds like fun, aside from being really interesting.
Blast. And I met the coolest people. And I kind of put all that stuff together into a little program for myself, my girlfriends, and my patients. And on the, you know, of how to approach nutrition differently, looking at fiber and magnesium and, you know, all the things that I talk about. It basically, long story short, I turned it into an online program. That was really successful. And then I turned it into a book called The Galveston Diet, named after the town where I raised my kids, you know, kind of like South Beach. Yeah. I would never call it a diet today. We know a diet is a nutrition plan. It's a pattern of eating. It's not a fad, but you know, I'm stuck with it. So then as I'm building on social media, talking about nutrition and menopause, people are coming after me with menopause questions flying out of, you know, everywhere. So
yeah,
instead
they're desperate,
of automatically
information, yeah.
them, I realized there's a gap in my knowledge here. So I just start reading everything. I joined the Menopause Society. I'm blowing through all of their guidelines. And I'm like, whoa, no one ever taught me this. ABOG was never putting this information in front of me. And so I was a hospitalist from 2018 to 2021. And then once COVID kind of calmed down and I could leave the hospital without, you know, feeling bad about it, I decided to open a menopause clinic and just focus on these patients. And so I kind of started out nutrition and menopause. And then I just, everything menopause became.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because I didn't realize, quite frankly, how new you were to this world. Because I actually got involved in the menopause world because my area of interest was minimally invasive surgery and alternatives. So in Chicago, I was at one time the busiest laparoscopic surgeon, did so many hysterectomies that were appropriate and indicated and really helped women. But at the same time, a lot of them became menopausal as a result. And I felt ill-equipped to manage after surgery. You know, a lot of people, when they talk about what makes a good surgeon, to me, what makes a good surgeon is what happens after the surgery, not just during the surgery. And so like you, I said, I got to learn this stuff. And I went out there and really did the deep dive and became very involved in the Menopause Society and started lecturing and doing research. And then ultimately I opened my menopause clinic. Unlike you, I was not smart and savvy about social media. So you have like, you know, 10 million followers and I have like, you know, 3 followers, but, and I could certainly learn a lot from you about that. But the point is, and I think what's really the point that we're both trying to make is that we don't learn this stuff in residency. It's not part of medical school. And the other thing is that it is so specialized that, and we were talking about this before we started taping, that I thought I was a really good gynecologist. I really did. And I was a good gynecologist and I was a really good surgeon. And I thought that I actually knew a fair amount about menopause. And then when I stopped doing all of that and only started doing menopause, and I thought, boy, did I miss the boat on a lot of things. And as new research comes out and as we continue to learn, what I really appreciate is just like, even though it's not an official specialty, you know, if you look at people that just do fertility or just do gynecologic oncology, and they are true experts in their field, and the same could be said for the menopause experts. So I want your take on this, the whole idea of maybe general OBGYNs shouldn't be doing menopause. We don't think they should be doing fertility. We don't think they should be doing gynecologic oncology. So why are we expecting general OBGYNs to suddenly be providing expert menopause care that you and I both know that a real menopause consultation takes an hour, I mean, to do it right. And for your annual one woman visit, a gynecologist allows 15 minutes and there's a lot of ground to cover. So should they even be doing it in the first place?
So I don't think so, because we'd have to add another year of training to the residency program in order to, right. And it's kind of mind boggling that, you know, in our menopause clinics, and we've talked about this, I'm a little bit of a neurologist. I'm a little bit of a cardiovascular, you know, I'm a little
bit psychiatrist.
Ortho, because I'm talking about, you know, psychiatry, mental health, all of it.
And dermatology. It's like, look at, I mean, all the vulvar issues that we, I mean, it just goes down. A pelvic floor special. I mean, yes, urologists, all of it.
I think until medical schools incorporate menopause into the curriculum of every single subspecialty, if every single subspecialty, and they're starting to do it, addresses the biologic difference between males and females and how females are different, especially when they lose estrogen, and how that affects whatever, you know, their specialty is, neurology, cardiology, whatever it is, even orthopedic surgery, then we're going to have to subspecialize. I don't think it's reasonable for the poor, busy OB-GYN, of which we both were, to be able to. The other part is insurance is not paying for this. And so, you know, there's no 1 hour visit. You know, you can't just expect to have a comprehensive menopause visit during your well woman exam.
Right.
It's not what it's there for.
Well, right. And when I tell women, one of the, you know, in my book, and I say, okay, how to make the most out of your appointment. And what I tell them is, number one, you have to make a separate appointment. This is not something that you handle in 30 seconds after you've already done your entire exam and talked maybe about, do you need contraception? And let's talk about your thyroid and blah, 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 blah. And then you're supposed to talk about menopause in 15 seconds. But women don't like hearing that because, I mean, you know, they've paid their copay, they've gone for their annual, they expect to get it all. And then when that doesn't happen, that's a big problem. So, I mean, this is a bigger issue than, you know, just you and I talking about this, of course, in terms of what to do. And then we don't have to get started with the access to menopause experts, because not only are there too few of us, but many of them are concierge and don't take insurance. And, you know, I think, you know, I work with MIDI, and one of the reasons I work with MIDI is because there is good access for women to get expert menopause care. But, and that's the answer for some people. But I think on a broader level, we really just need to look at the menopause plane in this world and how we approach it. So, all right. I know you have to go because you've got a busy schedule. I've got a busy schedule, but I am so glad that we were able to have this conversation. And squeeze this in and get this out quickly, because we really just want to get this out to the world. And we want women to know what the true experts think. And the true experts think, Kelly Casperson used the best word. What did she say? Not hogwash. It was some horse poop or something. I don't remember. It was so Kelly Casperson. But I loved the phrase that she used to say, this is like, you know, I think she said horse poop. And I think that about sums it up. This is horse poop.
Yeah, agree. 100%.
Any last words?
You know, we're just not going to stand for it. And we have voices and they're very loud, and we have education. We have the data on our side, and, you know, it's sad what happened. I think, you know, the headlines of the actual article were about, in, you know, improving menopause care and the conversation and, but the execution, when you read between the lines, was steeped in the past, and we're here for the future.
Couldn't have said it better. Thank you so much.
I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, and thank you for joining me. You will find lots more information in my Inside Information books, available on Amazon.com. And follow Francie as she navigates her way through vaginal dryness, hot flashes, and pretty much every menopausal symptom you can think of.
Taking back your day.